from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Most households today have internet connection, but a new study finds that 23% of low-income families rely on mobile-only access with data limits, while 52% experience interruptions and poor service with their mobile plans. This underconnectivity has a big impact on economic and learning opportunities for families, and we want to discuss the study, which was conducted by the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at the Sesame Workshop with a couple of those who are very involved in the study and who are actually, well, we've got the co-author of the report here in studio with us, Victoria Rideout, president of VJR Consulting. And the report was called Opportunity for All, as an interrogative question mark after that, Technology and Learning in Lower Income Families. Welcome, Victoria Rideout.
Thank you.
And another Victoria, Vicky Katz, I guess, Victoria, associate professor of communication at Rutgers, is joining us from Rutgers. She's a senior research scientist at the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop and also co-author of the report. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And let me begin with Victoria right out here in studio. Well, all internet access apparently is not created equal, and that's what the study showed. Let's talk about, though, sort of what the conception of the study was. You talked to, I guess, about 1,200 parents.
Mm-hmm. We did. And we wanted to focus in on parents who are from lower-income communities. So we interviewed 1,200 parents whose family incomes are below the national median average.
And about 65,000.
Yeah, that's right. 65,000 for families with kids. And it's all folks with school-age children. A lot of times when there's research on digital inclusion, there's surveys that are among all adults ages 18 and older. And it's a very different picture if you're thinking about why a senior citizen isn't connected to the internet or doesn't have broadband or a computer at home than it is if you're focusing on a family with school-aged children. And that's the reason that we wanted to hone in on this population, because we think it's the most important for our national digital inclusion efforts.
And it has a great deal of impact, as one can infer, not only on education with kids, but also economics, but it also affects the adults, if they're looking for a job or if they want to get medical information, all kinds of things.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're looking for extracurricular opportunities for their kids, you name it. There's a lot of reasons that today I think most of us would consider that the internet has become almost a necessity.
And Vicky Katz, what you also discovered is, let's maybe look at the numbers for a moment, that about half said that they have frequent problems with the internet, or a quarter say they can't really, they're relying entirely on a mobile device.
Right. So what we're forwarding with this study is the idea that rather than looking at a digital divide, which is a concept that was coined in the 1990s to make a distinction between people who had access to the internet and those who did not, is that the bigger issue is about being underconnected, because we found that 94% of these families have a connection to the internet. And even amongst those who are below the poverty line, it's 90%. But then you start digging a little bit harder and you see that there's all kinds of challenges when it comes to connectivity.
One of the biggest ones, I imagine, not being able to make payments.
A big one is not being able to make consistent payments. That's one of the ones that we heard very often with regard to how people describe why their access is inconsistent. It's also hitting the limit on your data plan. It might mean that you're on a mobile device and you don't have a data plan on it, but you use it in public spaces that have Wi-Fi access. And all of the forms of connectivity challenge that we asked families about in the survey were the challenges that came out of interviews that my team and I had done with 170 families in three school districts prior to doing the survey.
And let me commend those interviews, because they were done by phone, but they were done by phones to cells as well as landlines. There are a lot of polls that are done simply by landline, and so it's to your credit that you realize that you need cells in this as well. And Victoria Rideout, Yeah, so we've got a real gap here. I mean, you got, according to your study, 92 to 52 in percentages, 92 to 52 in terms of those who have laptops in their homes.
Right. And you find also that among the lowest income kids are just much more likely to have either mobile only access or to encounter these types of problems that Professor Katz was just talking about, where they're either their devices are old, there's too many people trying to share one device, they're trying to borrow their mom's smartphone to do their research and write their term paper on. I mean, it's not realistic in this day and age. And so you do find that the kids who have mobile-only access are like 20 percentage points less likely to be daily internet users. They're 20 percentage points less likely to be going online to just explore topics that they're interested in. These are the kinds of sort of student-centered, interest-driven learning that we're finding are so important for kids these days. And so those who don't have consistent or reliable internet access at home are definitely being left behind.
And the reality, if I go back to you, Professor Katz, behind all of this has to do also with data caps and interruptions and things of that sort. Talk about that a bit, if you would.
Yeah, so what we found both from the survey and from the open-ended interviews that preceded it is that cost is a massive factor, as we'd expected, but perhaps in more multidimensional ways than most people would anticipate. It's about the cost of the device. It's about the cost of internet access, and this was one that we thought was particularly interesting. We, both in the open-ended interviews before the survey and in the survey, asked questions about subsidized broadband access, because there are numerous programs nationally and locally designed for families that have school-aged children who are on free and reduced-cost lunch and qualify for that financially. And we were curious if families were addressing their cost issues by taking advantage of them. And what we find is, for the most part, that they're not. In the survey, we found that 6% of eligible families have ever used those programs. And in the interviews that we did, out of 170 families, 37 of them were or had ever used those programs. So there's a mismatch between the program's design and the realities and needs of the families that are supposed to be the ones who are benefiting from them. So the current efforts to address cost are not getting us where they need to get us.
And there was also a real disparity on ethnicities. Latino immigrants particularly, it turns out, are more likely to not have internet access or to rely solely on a mobile phone for internet connection?
Right. And that is one of the contributions of this study. Because we focused on lower-income families in their own right, rather than looking at families of school-age kids across the income spectrum and using income as a variable to do analyses, we could focus on the challenges that lower-income families experience on their own terms. One of the things that allowed us to do is that for the first time we could disaggregate Hispanics in the U.S. by whether or not they're a U.S.-born or immigrant. And so where prior studies had found that Latinos or Hispanics do not look like their white or black counterparts, what we found is that U.S.-born Hispanics look very much like their white and black counterparts on measures related to technology use, experience, confidence, and so on. It's the newcomers that are experiencing the greatest challenges, and we think that that's very valuable in terms of where we particularly need to be addressing our attention and our efforts.
And Vicky Katz, I'm sorry, Vicky Katz again, Associate Professor of Communication at Rutgers and Senior Research Scientist for the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop. Victoria Rideout is president of VJR Consulting and the co-author of the report. And again, the report is called Opportunity for All. You want to put a question mark after that, Technology and Learning in Lower Income Families. A lot of this does come back to money, Victoria Rideout. I mean, you've got service cutoffs, you've got slow service, you've got older technology and difficulty using because there are too many people sharing the technology. I mean, all those things do come back to just the fact that these people have less money.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why public policy, I think, has to be focused on the financial situation. And You know, if you do studies that focus on all of the adult population in the U.S. and look at who's not connected, then you run into these other issues like, is it relevant for me? Do I consider it important? And so on. And I think public policy has been kind of focused on that, that what we really need is more digital literacy and so on so that people understand why the internet's important for them. When you look at low-income families with kids, that's not the issue. It's not that they don't think it's important. It's not that they don't think it's critical for their kids' education. It's not that they don't feel confident using technology. It's the finances. And a lot of families are making huge sacrifices in order to have internet and computers for their kids. When Professor Katz was doing her qualitative research in various communities, including in Chula Vista, California, she found families that were sacrificing all kinds of other things in order to be able to afford the $40 or $50 a month of internet service. But a lot of families just simply can't do that.
What about the talk of internet providers that they want to offer low-cost programs and make things more accessible for these kind of families? Or, in fact, an FCC bill that's supposed to subsidize needy families that's in the works, I believe.
Yes, exactly. So right now what we have is a sort of a patchwork quilt of initiatives by different internet service providers across the country. Some of them are voluntary, where they offer a basic internet service plan to low-income families if you qualify economically. Others have been imposed by regulatory policies. So, for example, our provider here in the Bay Area, Comcast, has been required as conditions of mergers and acquisitions to offer something that they call internet essentials, where for just under 10 bucks a month, a family can get very basic internet access. The problem is, well, there's lots of problems with the current policy. Not all families live in a community that where the provider has that kind of policy. Sometimes they're very low speeds. One of Professor Katz's families said that, you know, they realized that they were spending $10 a month to get an internet service that they weren't even using because it was so slow. So they canceled their low-cost service. So what the FCC is considering now is something called the Lifeline policy, which would provide, make that kind of service available across the country, a basic service, internet service with some minimum standards as far as the speed of the broadband access and so on.
Talking about a study, digital divide persists, according to the study, despite widespread media mobile access. And you may want to comment on this. In fact, I'd like to invite listeners and invite your comments and thoughts. And some of you may have questions about the study itself. If so, feel free to join us now. We offer our toll-free number to you. That number is 866-733-6786. Still apparently a strong socioeconomic digital divide, and you may want to comment or bring a question to the fore here. Again, toll-free, our number is 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to communicate your thoughts, your concerns, or any ideas you want to put forward or join the conversation by going on our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm looking actually at an email right here from a listener, Katie, who writes, "This is why it's imperative that we fund public libraries, which is where many people need to go in order to access computers and the internet. We may not have complete equality in our society, but we can get pretty close to it with places like libraries." Point well made. We thank you for that, Katie. And again, many of you may want to make another point or an interesting point that came out of your study, Vicky Katz, that I couldn't help. I mean, kids are helping parents all over the place with computers. Let's face it. I mean, they're way ahead of us. Speaking about my own experience here with my kids especially. But there's a strong reliance, probably even a stronger reliance on these kids in terms of their parents getting help with technology.
Right, and that's actually a family dynamic that I've been studying for about 10 years across different groups on the income spectrum and looking specifically at immigrants as well. And, yeah, I mean, what we find really is, you know, if we were to summarize what we think is most interesting and important in the study, it's that most families are connected. Most of them are not as connected as they'd like to be, but they're really making the most of the connections that they have. And that includes the kinds of family activities that are happening around these technologies. So we asked parents questions about the kinds of activities that they do to help their kids learn about tech. And then we asked them the same questions with regard to whether their children help them to do those activities. And what we found is that as household income goes down, as parental income goes down, that the flows of assistance between parents and children start to change, and children become even more central to what technology use and learning is happening in that home. That doesn't mean that parents are not helping at all. It just means that the role of children becomes even more central as you go down the income and education spectrum. And perhaps what to us is very compelling and interesting is that when we asked parents who had more than one school-age child what kinds of activities their children do together, in houses where income was lower and parental education was lower, kids help each other more. So there is evidence, we think, of a compensating mechanism in families where if parents have less technical skills and digital literacy, kids are helping each other to learn more. And we think that tells us something about the tremendous strengths within families that are too often only defined by deficits, like deficits in income or parental education. And we think that's really important for policymakers to know that they've got really serious partners on the other side of the table.
And again, just to remind listeners, this forum segment, we're focusing on a new study which bears out the economic divide that creates a great deal of more digital divide than had been presumed earlier. And again, we invite you to join us at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. Let me go to your calls and let's begin. Don, with you, you're on the air. Morning.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I just wanted to comment, I work as a Spanish language interpreter at the California School for the Deaf in Fremont, and would like to particularly back up what the comments have been made about the Hispanic community and the fact that access is so difficult because of the dependency on perhaps one mobile device with limited broadband access or time availability. And that's something that we see on a daily basis working at the school because we're dealing with many families. Not only that, but the lack of familiarity of the recently arrived families with technology, especially the parents, who in our case are in need of really helping out their kids due to the deafness of the children. So it's just basically to back up what I've heard being said, and hopefully there's a way that it can be resolved.
Well, Don, I thank you for that, and I appreciate hearing from you. Let me go to some more callers here because we get a lot of people on the lines. Ann, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I am just intrigued. I'm a teacher in Oakland, and I worked recently with Internet Essentials for a student who parents don't speak English. This is very, very typical here, who was applying for colleges, and Oakland has a wonderful program called Oakland Technology Exchange. We were able to get her computer, get her all set up, and then turns out the family didn't, the apartment where they were living didn't have the cable necessary to have it all work out in the end. So very frustrating. She missed some deadlines for colleges. And, I mean, beyond that, there's just some very obvious problems with how it is currently working, even with really wonderful structures and support systems in place.
And I thank you for that call. Certainly getting a lot of testament here, personal experiences of educators and volunteer teachers and so forth about the problems. What about the solutions? Let me go to you on this first, Vicki Katz. What can we do?
Well, I wanted to thank both Ann and Don for their calls and their comments, and I think they're just underlining, we hope, that what we're giving voice to here is something that's really part of the lived experience of not just the families, but of so many providers and professionals who work with them. I think that what both callers are pointing to here is that there's a real link in this day and age between the social incorporation of immigrant families and their connectivity to the Internet, given what resources are available there. And so I think we've got some work to do in thinking about how digital equity relates to other forms of social equality, right? I mean, if our public schools and our mission and what this country's bedrock foundation is that progress and effort through our public schools lead to social mobility and has for generations of immigrants since this country was founded. You know, the idea that missing college deadlines because of issues of connectivity in an apartment building when your teachers have gone above and beyond to make sure that you have what you need we can do better than that. I think that the FCC's work to reform Lifeline is a critical step in the right direction, that we should have a federal uniform system that helps us to address the issues around cost. I think that continuing to support community institutions and locations that serve as important intermediaries for families, schools, libraries, and the places that are specific to local communities that people trust and go to and spend time in is really important. And I think the third thing is really to work creatively to make the families themselves partners for the changes they want to see for their families and in their communities, rather than designing programs that are going to give them something. Make them part of the process, because I think that the ideas and solutions that come from people themselves are the ones that will sustain the change that we want to see going forward.
Well, here's an email, and Victoria Rideout, let me go to you on this, from Bruce, who writes, Oakland Technology Exchange, OTX, refurbishes and distributes low-cost computers for families, schools, and organizations, and holds classes and training sessions. If you want to help, you can donate your unused computer gear or sign up to volunteer. And he wants to know, what other resources are there if people want to contribute?
Well, again, right now, it's more like a bit of a patchwork across the country. I mean, there's a lot of organizations like that that are doing great work. We encountered another in Virginia where some high school students who went to a public school there that was focused on technology were doing tutoring for kids from another school, discovered that some of these kids didn't have computers at home and couldn't fathom how could these lower-income kids possibly do their homework and stay up with their schoolwork without having a computer at home. So these high school kids started their own program called Reboot for Youth, in which they're accepting donations of older technology, which they are refurbishing as part of their schoolwork and providing to their peers who don't have computers at home. So there
it's a very hopeful story. Isn't it
nice? Yeah. But at the same time, it probably shouldn't be left up to that. I mean, this is something that has become so critical when you're talking about, like, the story we just heard about a kid who missed a college application deadline. The implications are very significant.
And the consequences.
The consequences are important. And this is technology that really has the possibility to help bridge economic and educational divides and create and foster more equality and more opportunity. And if we don't get it right, it's going to have the opposite effect.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me bring Zachary in. Zachary, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Since we're talking about the cost of internet, what about the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which was supposed to lower the cost of internet for people and increase speeds, but it's actually gone up since then, and the ISPs have let their infrastructure basically fall apart. And I'll take my comment off here.
All right. Well, we'll let that come on stand unless either Vicky Katz or Victoria Rideout want to respond to it. Victoria,
well, I mean, we do have notoriously slow internet speeds and high prices in this country in general, for all of us, as compared to the rest of the world. But in particular, for lower-income families, the policy that we think might help with covering the costs of broadband access at home is the Lifeline policy. It was established under the Reagan administration to make sure low-income people have access to communication technology. Right now it covers mobile phones, but the FCC is considering expanding that so that you would have a small subsidy to apply to broadband internet access at home as well.
And we'll give more callers access. Let me go next to Santa Cruz and welcome you, Jeff. Hi, you're on Forum.
Yeah, hi. Well, I would like to see the internet be just available to anyone and everyone, no matter what income group, like roads are.
That's the way it was supposed to be. Remember all the talk about superhighways and all that sort of thing? But we're talking about, really, the study bears out underconnectedness for people who are under the median mark of median family incomes. Thank you, Jeff. Let me get another caller on here. We'll go to San Francisco. Mia, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm a social worker in San Francisco, and I see the importance of the digital conversations beyond the academics, and I understand the importance of connectivity with academic performance, but I'm wondering about the social-emotional impact if these kids don't have that access and they're not part of the digital conversation. If you had any kind of feedback from the families in your study and how that was impacting these kids, middle and high school kids particularly.
Well, Professor Katz, you were talking about the family dynamic. Family dynamic has a lot to do with the social world that the kids live in, and
There's no question that she's right. And, you know, we tend to talk, when it comes to issues around equity, as she's pointing out, we tend to talk very much about students in schools and about education as if these things are separate from the rest of children's lives. What we've been pushing with the study is that they're not just students in schools, they're kids in families, and that it's not just about the outcomes and developmental trajectories and the social and emotional well-being of kids. That's tied to the well-being of their parents, and having parents who can apply for better jobs online and get skills training and apply for resources and services they need and find a healthcare clinic or resource when they need it more easily, find a deal online for a product the family needs rather than paying full freight at the corner store. These things matter, and they matter in kind of everyday ways and in big ways for the overall well-being of our families across generations. So I think the caller for making that point is really, really important.
And I'm looking at an email from Tracy who says, my daughter has a very good friend at GitHub who is now leading a program to provide internet access in at least 25 low-income housing projects across the country. Wish I could provide more information, but it is a hopeful sign. Indeed. And Diana writes, the library in Los Angeles, Main Library, lives metaphorically and in reality at the end of Hope Street, where hope begins. Let me get another caller on. That's you, Jay. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm always really hesitant to prescribe a solution or to think that a solution could come from the government because of all of the bureaucracy. And I wanted to ask the scholars if they think a better solution would come from tech startups and nonprofits.
Well, we go back to that idea, Victoria Wright, that maybe the technology industry itself ought to take a more active role in this. Can they find solutions? Are they working to find solutions?
Well, you know, as we mentioned, there are companies that are providing a basic internet service plan to families that qualify economically. Some are doing it voluntarily. Cox is doing it voluntarily. But others have been required and to do that, such as Comcast, and as conditions of their merger plans and so on. And so I would say that while we would hope that there would even be a financial interest for these companies to get more families online, we just haven't seen it happen yet. I think companies have been lagging. I think philanthropy hasn't been terribly successful yet either. I mean, you look at some of the biggest initiatives, even among the philanthropists who come from the industry, you know, that some of them have flopped when they've been trying to do things in communities. And I'm thinking of the Zuckerberg and New Jersey schools recently and so on. So I think it's just a challenge we haven't quite gotten our hands around yet.
Thank you, Victoria Wright. Thank you, Vicky Katz. The study, do we have it online?
You can go
to our website and read about the study. Or read the study itself, kqed.org/forum. And again, Victoria Rideout is president of VJR Consulting, and Vicky Katz is an associate professor of communications at Rutgers. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. I'm sorry, Vicky, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, if I could. They can find the full study at digitalequityforlearning.org, and the study was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I wanted to mention that and thank them. Thank you so much.
And again, it's at our website. Thank you both. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.